Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link. On this Friday, July the 15th, I am Abubakar Jallo, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. In the next 25 minutes, mass evacuations of foreign nationals are underway in South Sudan, but South Sudan is trying to flee tensions in the country, are having extreme difficulties.
We have not yet witnessed a major population outflow into neighboring countries, but we have had reports of the border, South Sudan-Uganda border, you know, still closed.
Now, who will succeed Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma as the next chairperson of the African Union?
A lot of people in Eastern, Northern and Western Africa feel it should now be the turn of a member who is not from the Southern African Development Community.
And also, how does it feel to be a smoker in a country with strict anti-smoking laws? Well, we will tell you why cigarette smokers in Kenya think they are being discriminated against for their choice of lifestyle. Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Now, the United States, India, Germany and other countries are evacuating their citizens from South Sudan, where there are fears that fighting could break out again anytime in spite of a ceasefire. South Sudanese trying to flee the country by road have reportedly been torn back at their borders. Ahmed Wasame is the representative of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, in South Sudan. He's also been evacuated to Nairobi, Kenya, from where he spoke to my colleague Eunice Wanjiru about the current plight of internally displaced people.
We have not yet witnessed a major population outflow into neighboring countries, but we have had reports of the border, South Sudan-Uganda border, you know, still closed, thereby affecting freedom of movement of people into Uganda. So we are aware of that, and UNHCR is closely monitoring the situation. We are also aware of relocation and evacuation of Western embassy staff. The United Nations has started evacuating some of its non-essential staff out of Juba. But UN and non-governmental organizations are in Juba and elsewhere in the country trying to provide emergency humanitarian aid and protection to the people recently affected. And we have a number of 40,000 people newly displaced as a result of this renewed conflict in South Sudan. So while some organizations have pulled out of their staff, essential UN personnel as well as non-governmental organizations are currently providing much-needed humanitarian assistance, including food aid, health care, water, sanitation, shelter and non-food items. Access to the affected population is still posing difficulties and challenges for humanitarian organizations. But nevertheless, efforts are being made to reach out to those in need of assistance.
And what are UNHCR plans in case the ceasefire fails to hold?
We hope the ceasefire will continue to hold. UNHCR is a member of a humanitarian country team and is operating under the leadership of the humanitarian coordinator based in Juba. UNHCR is the lead agency of international protection. We will continue to exercise and discharge our responsibilities in sending protection to the civilians affected. If the conflict deteriorates, then UNHCR will certainly be part of an interagency focus on other scenarios. We are operating outside South Sudan, in Kenya, in Uganda, Ethiopia, where we are, UNHCR is assisting refugees, over 800,000 of them. It's a difficult environment, but we will continue and extend our protection, support and services to the population inside the country.
Ahmed Wasame, UNHCR representative in South Sudan. With Western powers pulling out their citizens from South Sudan, is the international community deserting the country? Eunice Wanjiru put this question to Magdi El-Ghizouli, a Sudanese academic and fellow at the Rift Valley Institute in Germany.
I think it is, but so it's left behind the state authority is not capable of managing gun power. But it has very little concern for the fate of the millions of South Sudanese who will continue to live with the legacy of the Liberation War and of the political fallout of the two principles. There was a time where there were negotiations. Western powers accepted the blackmail of the two principals, Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, and agreed to a political deal that is based essentially on their survival and their application of the same situation that led to the civil war originally.
What sort of international initiative is needed to help South Sudan get this crisis under control?
Of course, the resolution of this has to be political, but there has to be enough pressure on South Sudan, on the South Sudanese government, and on the armed opposition to work out a refreshment of the peace deal. I think the peace deal has to be reworked in a way that clears the path for an alternative government to the one led by the two princes. In other words, the peace agreement should be reworked in a way that keeps Salva Kiir and Riek Machar out of the balance of power and not in the balance of power, as is the case now.
So do you think sanctions on an arms embargo would help?
Well, of course, these are symbolic gestures, really. If you're a government and you want to get arms, you will know how to get them despite UN sanctions. Of course, it might make a lot of sort of Western liberals happy to see that, yes, our governments are doing something by imposing an arms embargo, but I'm not sure how that would work out inside South Sudan.
When we look at the two warring factions, do they really want peace? How strong is their commitment to the peace deal that was signed?
They want power. They might be forced to accept terms of a peace if this guarantees their mutual existence. So they would accept a peace deal if that is the way they can survive. But if they think they can get greater gains through war, they will not shy back from war, as they have already now twice.
What more could the regional actors, in particular IGAD, be doing to stop the fighting?
The member states of IGAD that have vested interests in South Sudan, particularly Uganda and Ethiopia, have over time become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. People who've been involved in the mediation would tell you how far they have made that negotiation process more difficult by insisting on particular terms and refusing others in a way that serves their own interests. Of course, we know how Uganda intervened in the first phase of the war, where the Ugandan army went to South Sudan to protect the government of Salva Kiir from the insurgency. And I think the Ugandan army is back again in South Sudan, this time to evacuate Ugandan citizens out of the country. So there's a lot to say about the IGAD countries in terms of the way, if there is a deal between them on how to settle the war, maybe that would make things easier. But for the time being, this deal does not exist.
Mark D. El Ghizouli, academic and fellow at the Rift Valley Institute in Germany. And this is Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
Now, African heads of state and government are meeting this weekend in Kigali, Rwanda, to mark the highlight of the African Union summit that began last Sunday. On the agenda was the election of the next chairperson to succeed outgoing South African Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. But as of now, it seems the election will be postponed. Eunice Wanjiru caught up with Ludger Shadomski, head of DW's Amharic service, who's been closely following the summit.
Three candidates have been put forward officially by the closing deadline. We have Uganda, Botswana and Equatorial Guinea. I think the latter one is out for obvious reasons. There are gross human rights abuses in that country, and also there are some internal politics involved. The choice really is between Uganda and Botswana. Botswana is, of course, member of the SADC, and since Mrs. Zuma is from South Africa herself, obviously a lot of people in Eastern, Northern and Western Africa feel it should now be the turn of a member who is not from the Southern African Development Community. Having said that, I think there's general agreement that none of the candidates put forward has the experience and the stature to fill this position. So a very likely scenario seems to be at this point that the decision will be transferred to the summit in January in Addis Ababa next year, and that in the meantime some kind of deal is being struck. There are several candidates whose names have been put forward. One is the former Tanzanian president Kikwete, and also Ramtam Lamamra, the current Algerian foreign minister, is also one of the candidates. He used to be on the Peace and Security Council of the Commission. He did a very good job at the time. Then again, the question is, will most member states support a candidate from North Africa? So a lot of behind-the-scene politics at this point.
Okay,
still.
So let's talk about the performance of Dlamini Zuma. Has the African Union registered any progress under her leadership?
It really depends on who you talk to in Addis Ababa. To start with, she was very seldom in Addis Ababa. People saw very little of her, and they felt she was involved in politics in South Africa more than at the helm of the African Union. Then, of course, if we remember how she came into the job in the first place in 2012, she needed 4 rounds of voting at the time to beat her rival at the time, Jean Ping. So subsequently, she found it very, very hard to convince those countries who did not vote for her at the time. And South Africa really put up a very almost aggressive kind of campaign. It did not go down well with a lot of countries. So I think she came off to a bad start. And subsequently, she did try to push through reforms. I think she brought some kind of professionalism to the African Union. She also brought what one observer calls South African sort of know-how, also in terms of politics. She did engage China, South Korea, and a number of other countries rather well. She's been very, very strong on women and gender issues. And lastly, she came up with this idea of an African Union Vision 2063. Some people have said, it's just a vision and it's still far off. And why doesn't the AU look to more pressing needs at home? Others say she was the first chairperson to give the African Union some kind of vision. And they really appreciated that.
Ludgar Shadomski, head of DW's Amharic service, and still to come, Kenya's tough anti-smoking regulations. But before that, how rampant is mob justice in Africa?
Human rights.
Jungle justice, also known as mob justice, is rampant across sub-Saharan Africa. Every day, at least one person in the continent faces severe torture or even death in the hands of angry crowds. This controversial practice of local judgment has resulted in the loss of many innocent lives. In this report compiled by Neka Luke, activists are describing the practice as a violation of people's right to fair trial.
Jungle justice is when people take laws into their hands to execute punishments on alleged offenders of perceived heinous crimes. Jungle justice, also called mob or street justice, is a form of extrajudicial killing. The victims are deprived of their rights under the rule of law. And justice is meted out in a barbaric manner, usually through stoning or burning of the individuals in full view of the public. Cameroon and Nigeria are reported to record the highest rates of jungle justice in the continent. Hawa Yusuf, a criminologist at the Kaduna State University, said that most victims of jungle justice are innocent of the crimes they are punished for.
A lot of innocent people become victims, and a lot of innocent people have lost their lives.
The people who employ this practice usually pass their own judgments on an offender based on some locally understood code of conduct or standard of morality. It has become the fastest way to deliver justice to alleged criminals and offenders, as it has also been reported that sometimes the local police watch and do nothing. Jungle justice is a serious abuse of human rights, which has continued to persist and grow in Africa. The speed of the African judicial process is one reason people take the law into their own hands. Enoch Chibuwana, a lawyer from Malawi, also blames deficiencies of the Africa criminal justice system for the rise in jungle justice.
There are some deficiencies in criminal justice, so it's likely that this could be some kind of backlash.
Jungle justice has not reduced crime in Africa, but rather has increased human rights abuses in the continent. Barrister Festus Okoye, a Nigerian human rights activist, says enlightenment and massive sensitization campaign against jungle justice is the way forward.
We need proper education, proper enlightenment of our people to tell them about the consequences when somebody has not been convicted by a properly constituted court of law.
Most Africans yearn for a society where justice and fairness is the order of the day. Hence, the need for its government to ensure an end to jungle justice, which has taken the lives of many innocent citizens in Africa.
Neka Luke with that report. In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, it's not that easy to be a smoker anymore. Strict anti-smoking laws in public places that came into force a few years ago have reduced the number of places where smoking is still permitted. While the laws are supposed to protect non-smokers and children from the health hazards caused by tobacco, smokers now feel discriminated against, not least because the designated smoking areas are not always very inviting. This report by DW's Linda Staude is now presented by Samantha Early.
Endless lines of cars are slowly moving through the city centre of Nairobi. Notorious minibuses called matatus are honking loudly, trying to shoulder their way through the traffic jam while thick blue diesel smoke is taking over the air. In the midst of this madness, on a channeling island on a four-lane street, is a small kiosk. But instead of selling newspapers, sweets and bottles of water, the shaky little shack offers something much rarer, a shelter for smokers.
Very squeezed space, and you can have over 100 people mashing up between each other trying to have a cigarette.
That's Lewis, one of the smokers who regularly comes here. The public smoking centre, as the sign above the entrance of the kiosk proudly announces, is pretty ramshackle. Just like all the other ones in town, says fellow smoker Ben Sondego.
They are mismanaged, they are in bad shape. The city council is not taking care of them, as you can see.
The windows don't have glass, and the shutters that are supposed to keep the rain out have come unhinged, loosely dangling around outside. The pieces of metal that serve as ashtrays are overflowing, and the few seats inside the kiosk are falling apart.
The way they took to smokers now in this country, they took us as very, very useless people.
That's James Mwangi. He complains that smokers should be treated with respect and that the city should give them places where they can smoke a cigarette in peace. The old man comes here several times a day to smoke amid the exhaust fumes of the heavy traffic. He doesn't really have a choice, says fellow smoker Lewis.
It's not much of a choice. Before, we used to just walk around and smoke. But now, because of the laws and regulations, you can't risk doing that. You'll be arrested very quickly and have a very tough time.
Kenya's Tobacco Control Act prohibits smoking in all public buildings, on public streets and squares, on the pavement, and even in cars where underage passengers are present. While it's aimed at protecting non-smokers, Lewis feels like that's violating his rights.
When you're telling me that I'm not supposed to smoke in the car, as in that's my personal space.
Around 3 million Kenyans are smokers. With a population of roughly 45 million, the proportion of smokers is larger than almost anywhere else south of the Sahara. But Kefa Ombachi, Director of Public Health in Kenya, defends the strict law.
We are only for public health concerns of the population of Kenya and the people who actually stay in Kenya. We are only trying to safeguard people from actually issues that we can be able to prevent.
And the protection comes with hefty fines. Those caught with a cigarette in a place where it's prohibited risk 6 months behind bars, or a fine of roughly 5,000 euros.
And that report was compiled by Linda Staude.
Your C.
It's that time of the week when we turn the microphone over to you, the listener, to hear what you have to say about the stories we've been reporting. Jane Aiko Kumet and Fred Mvunyi are here with this week's Your Say.
Let's start this segment in South Sudan, where shootings between soldiers loyal to President Salva Kiir and former rebels allied to Riek Machar claimed the lives of about 300 people.
Maina Waruyungi said the two warlords, referring to President Salva Kiir and his deputy, should be sent to the International Criminal Court soonest before they bring more death and other calamities to the people of South Sudan. This is for their private and parochial interests.
And Chris Malyongovi says, prayers, love and solidarity are with my brothers of South Sudan. Comrade Yoweri Museveni should speedily move the Ugandan army in South Sudan to stop the bloodshed.
Well, our listener Maria Ngovi's request has been heard. The Ugandan government has announced it is sending a small number of troops to South Sudan, but only to rescue the Ugandans who are stuck in there.
And we move on to another topic, and it's something to do with Zimbabwe. The man behind the hashtag This Flag Protest, Evan Mawarire, has been released by a magistrate court. Africa Link has been covering the shutdown protest extensively. After his arrest on Tuesday, one of our articles on DW's Facebook page attracted many comments.
Many comments indeed, Jen. Carmen Jason says, "The world needs to know. Let us come together for peace, for justice, for Pastor Evan. He is a noble, brave, courageous, honest, peaceful man who has stood up to the corruption and injustice of our country."
And Jason adds, "The government fears him because he has united us, he has inspired us, and he has given us hope and courage. He is the kind of man that every person should aspire to be."
Dumisani Sisimai also expressed his feelings on political situation in Zimbabwe. He says, "I have lived my entire life in fear, unable to express how I feel, but that has come to an end now."
And finally, Germany has officially referred to the Herero and Nama massacre in Namibia as genocide. Just to remind our listeners that between 1904 and 1908, German soldiers drove thousands of Herero and Nama into the desert, leading to the death of a disputed number thought to be around 100,000 people.
Yes, this topic has picked up many comments across the globe on our Facebook page.
Eric Erickson Jr. says, "No matter what Germans are trying to do now, the reality never changes. They intentionally destroyed a whole society. Oh, they did so in order to say, we are sorry." And he concludes his comment with a question: have Germany and Germans learned something from these evils?
And Chris Mariangovi seems to be on German side. He says, "Germany has been sensible by acknowledging many things in Africa. They are the only country which compensated Africans who fought on their side in the two world wars."
Well, that's all we had time for. Until next week, goodbye.
Jane Ayeko Kumet and Fred Mvunyi, thank you. If you'd also like to have your comment read here on Africa Link, then send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com. You can also send us a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, or you can also send us a text message to +491609575910.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/Africa Link. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter. dw.com/Africa Link.
And before we leave for the weekend, a reminder of our main stories. Mass evacuations of foreign nationals is underway in South Sudan, but South Sudanese trying to flee tensions in the country are being turned away from the borders. African Union heads of state are meeting at the AU summit in Kigali this weekend, but the election of the next chairperson is likely to be postponed. Elsewhere in the news, at least 8 people were killed on Thursday in a fire at an orphanage in the South African city of Durban. Many of those killed were children, with the youngest being 8 years old. The suspected extremist, who was being held at a police station in Kapengura, Western Kenya, for killing 4 police officers, has been identified as a rogue officer. The police had said the attacker was a suspected recruiter for the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. That's all we had time for, and as always, thank you for listening. Isaac Mugabe will be here with you on Monday, and do join him if you can. From me, Abubakar Jallo in Bonn, have a pleasant weekend.